Chapter 3, Action in Time. Human Action. Number 1, The Temporal Character of Praxeology. The notion of change implies the notion of temporal sequence. A rigid, eternally immutable universe would be out of time, but it would be dead. The concepts of change and of time are inseparably linked together. Action aims at change and is therefore in the temporal order. Human reason is even incapable of conceiving the idea of timeless existence and of timeless action. He who acts distinguishes between the time before the action, the time absorbed by the action, and the time after the action has been finished. He cannot be neutral with regard to the lapse of time. Logic and mathematics deal with an ideal system of thought. The relations and implications of their system are coexistent and interdependent. We may say as well that they are synchronous or that they are out of time. A perfect mind could grasp them all in one thought. Man's inability to accomplish this makes thinking itself an action, proceeding step by step from the less satisfactory state of insufficient cognition to the more satisfactory state of better insight. But the temporal order in which knowledge is acquired must not be confused with the logical simultaneity of all parts of this a prioristic deductive system. Within this system, the notions of anteriority and consequence are metaphorical only. They do not refer to the system, but to our action in grasping it. The system itself implies neither the category of time nor that of causality. There is functional correspondence between elements, but there is neither cause nor effect. What distinguishes epistemologically the praxeological system from the logical system epistemologically is precisely that it implies the categories both of time and of causality. The praxeological system, too, is a prioristic and deductive. As a system, it is out of time, but change is one of its elements. The notions of sooner and later and of cause and effect are among its constituents. Anteriority and consequence are essential concepts of praxeological reasoning. So is the irreversibility of events. In the frame of the praxeological system, any reference to functional correspondence is no less metaphorical and misleading than is the reference to anteriority and consequence in the frame of the logical system. Number 2, past, present, and future. It is acting that provides man with the notion of time and makes him aware of the flux of time. The idea of time is a praxeological category. Action is always directed toward the future. It is essentially and necessarily always a planning and acting for a better future. Its aim is always to render future conditions more satisfactory than they would be without the interference of action. The uneasiness that impels a man to act is caused by a dissatisfaction with expected future conditions, as they would probably develop if nothing were done to alter them. In any case, action can influence only the future, never the present, that with every infinitesimal fraction of a second sinks down into the past. Man becomes conscious of time when he plans to convert a less satisfactory present state into a more satisfactory future state. For contemplative meditation, time is merely duration. La durée pure, dont l'écoulement est continu, est du long pas, par gradation insensible, d'un état l'autre, continuité réellement vécue. The now of the present is continually shifted to the past and is retained in the memory only. Reflecting about the past, say the philosophers, man becomes aware of time. However, it is not recollection that conveys to man the categories of change and of time, but the will to improve the conditions of his life. Time as we measure it by various mechanical devices is always past, and time as the philosophers use this concept is always either past or future. The present is, from these aspects, nothing but an ideal boundary line separating the past from the future. But from the praxeological aspect, there is between the past and the future a real extended present. Action is as such in the real present because it utilizes the instant and thus embodies its reality. Later retrospective reflection discerns in the instant passed away first of all the action and the conditions which it offered to action. That which can no longer be done or consumed because the opportunity for it has passed away contrasts the past with the present. That which cannot yet be done or consumed because the conditions for undertaking it or the time for its ripening have not yet come, contrasts the future with the past. The present offers to acting opportunities and tasks for which it was hitherto too early and for which it will be hereafter too late. The present qua duration is the continuation of the conditions and opportunities given for acting. Every kind of action requires special conditions to which it must be adjusted with regard to the aim sought. The concept of the present is therefore different for various fields of action. It has no reference whatever to the various methods of measuring the passing of time by spatial movements. The present encloses as much of the time passed away as still is actual, i.e., of importance for acting. The present contrasts itself according to the various actions one has in view with the Middle Ages, with the 19th century, with the past year, month, or day, but no less with the hour, minute, or second just passed away. If a man says, "Nowadays Zeus is no longer worshipped," he has a present in mind other than the motor car driver who thinks, "Now is still too early to turn." As the future is uncertain, it always remains undecided and vague how much of it we can consider as now and present. If a man had said in 1913, "At present now in Europe, freedom of thought is undisputed," he would have not foreseen that this present would very soon be a past. Number 3, the economization of time. Man is subject to the passing of time. He comes into existence, grows, becomes old, and passes away. His time is scarce. He must economize it as he does other scarce factors. The economization of time has a peculiar character because of the uniqueness and irreversibility of the temporal order. The importance of these facts manifests itself in every part of the theory of action. Only one fact must be stressed at this point. The economization of time is independent of the economization of economic goods and services. Even in the land of Caucane, man would be forced to economize time, provided he were not immortal and not endowed with eternal youth and indestructible health and vigor. Although all his appetites could be satisfied immediately without any expenditure of labor, he would have to arrange his time schedule, as there are states of satisfaction which are incompatible and cannot be consummated at the same time. For this man, too, time would be scarce and subject to the aspect of sooner and later. Number 4, the temporal relation between actions. Two actions of an individual are never synchronous. Their temporal relation is that of sooner and later. Actions of various individuals can be considered as synchronous only in the light of the physical methods for the measurement of time. Synchronism is a praxeological notion only with regard to the concerted efforts of various acting men. A man's individual actions succeed one another. They can never be effected at the same instant. They can only follow one another in more or less rapid succession. There are actions which serve several purposes at one blow. It would be misleading to refer to them as a coincidence of various actions. People have often failed to recognize the meaning of the term scale of value, and have disregarded the obstacles preventing the assumption of synchronism in the various actions of an individual. They have interpreted a man's various acts as the outcome of a scale of value, independent of these acts and preceding them, and of a previously devised plan whose realization they aim at. The scale of value and the plan to which duration and immutability for a certain period of time were attributed were hypostasized into the cause and motive of the various individual actions. Synchronism, which could not be asserted with regard to various acts, was then easily discovered in the scale of value and in the plan. But this overlooks the fact that the scale of value is nothing but a constructed tool of thought. The scale of value manifests itself only in real acting. It can be discerned only from the observation of real acting. It is therefore impermissible to contrast it with real acting and to use it as a yardstick for the appraisal of real actions. It is no less impermissible to differentiate between rational and allegedly irrational acting on the basis of a comparison of real acting with earlier drafts and plans for future actions. It may be very interesting that yesterday's goals were set for today's acting other than those really aimed at today. But yesterday's plans do not provide us with any more objective and non-arbitrary standard for the appraisal of today's real acting than any other ideas and norms. The attempt has been made to attain the notion of a non-rational action by this reasoning. If A is preferred to B and B to C, logically A should be preferred to C. But if actually C is preferred to A, we are faced with a mode of acting to which we cannot ascribe consistency and rationality. This reasoning disregards the fact that two acts of an individual can never be synchronous. If in one action A is preferred to B, and in another action B to C, it is, however short the interval between the two actions may be, not permissible to construct a uniform scale of value in which A precedes B and B precedes C. Nor is it permissible to consider a later third action as coincident with the two previous actions. All that the example proves is that value judgments are not immutable and that therefore a scale of value, which is abstracted from various necessarily non-synchronous actions of an individual, may be self-contradictory. One must not confuse the logical concept of consistency vis-a-vis absence of contradiction and the praxeological concept of consistency, vis-a-vis constancy or clinging to the same principles. Logical consistency has its place only in thinking. Constancy has its place only in acting. Constancy and rationality are entirely different notions. If one's valuations have changed, unremitting faithfulness to the once espoused principles of action, merely for the sake of constancy, would not be rational but simply stubborn. Only in one respect can acting be constant, in preferring the more valuable to the less valuable. If the valuations change, acting must change also. Faithfulness under changed conditions to an old plan would be nonsensical. A logical system must be consistent and free of contradictions because it implies the coexistence of all its parts and theorems. In acting, which is necessarily in the temporal order, there cannot be any question of such consistency. Acting must be suited to the purpose, and purposefulness requires adjustment to changing conditions. Presence of mind is considered a virtue in acting men. A man has presence of mind if he has the ability to think and to adjust his acting so quickly that the interval between the emergence of new conditions and the adaptations of his actions to them becomes as short as possible. If constancy is viewed as faithfulness to a plan once designed without regard to changes in conditions, then presence of mind and quick reaction are the very opposite of constancy. When the speculator goes to the stock exchange, he may sketch a definite plan for his operations. Whether or not he clings to this plan, his actions are rational, also in the sense which those eager to distinguish rational acting from irrational attribute to the term rational. This speculator in the course of the day may embark upon transactions which an observer, not taking into account the changes occurring in market conditions, will not be able to interpret as the outcome of constant behavior. But the speculator is firm in his intention to make profits and to avoid losses. Accordingly, he must adjust his conduct to the change in market conditions and in his own judgment concerning the future development of prices. However one twists things, one will never succeed in formulating the notion of irrational action whose irrationality is not founded upon an arbitrary judgment of value. Let us suppose that somebody has chosen to act inconstantly for no other purpose than for the sake of refuting the praxeological assertion that there is no irrational action. What happens here is that a man aims at a particular goal, vis-a-vis the refutation of a praxeological theorem, and that he accordingly acts differently from what he would have done otherwise. He has chosen an unsuitable means for the refutation of praxeology. That is all. Number 1. Uncertainty in acting. The uncertainty of the future is already implied in the very notion of action. That man acts and that the future is uncertain are by no means two independent matters. They are only two different modes of establishing one thing. We may assume that the outcome of all events and changes is uniquely determined by eternal unchangeable laws governing becoming and development in the whole universe. We may consider the necessary connection and interdependence of all phenomena, i.e., their causal concatenation as the fundamental and ultimate fact. We may entirely discard the notion of undetermined chance. But however that may be or appear to the mind of a perfect intelligence, the fact remains that to acting man the future is hidden. If man knew the future, he would not have to choose and would not act. He would be like an automaton reacting to stimuli without any will of his own. Some philosophers are prepared to explode the notion of man's will as an illusion and self-deception because man must unwittingly behave according to the inevitable laws of causality. They may be right or wrong from the point of view of the prime mover or the cause of itself. However, from the human point of view, action is the ultimate thing. We do not assert that man is free in choosing and acting. We merely establish the fact that he chooses and acts and that we are at a loss to use the methods of the natural sciences for answering the question why he acts this way and not otherwise. Natural science does not render the future predictable. It makes it possible to foretell the results to be obtained by definite actions. But it leaves impredictable two spheres: that of insufficiently known natural phenomena and that of human acts of choice. Our ignorance with regard to these two spheres taints all human actions with uncertainty. Apodictic certainty is only within the orbit of the deductive system of a prioristic theory. The most that can be attained with regard to reality is probability. It is not the task of praxeology to investigate whether or not it is permissible to consider as certain some of the theorems of the empirical natural sciences. This problem is without practical importance for praxeological considerations. At any rate, the theorems of physics and chemistry have such a high degree of probability that we are entitled to call them certain for all practical purposes. We can practically forecast the working of a machine constructed according to the rules of scientific technology. But the construction of a machine is only a part in a broader program that aims at supplying the consumers with the machine's products. Whether this was or was not the most appropriate plan depends on the development of future conditions, which at the time of the plan's execution cannot be forecast with certainty. Thus, the degree of certainty with regard to the technological outcome of the machine's construction, whatever it may be, does not remove the uncertainty inherent in the whole action. Future needs and valuations, the reaction of men to changes in conditions, future scientific and technological knowledge, future ideologies and policies can never be foretold with more than a greater or smaller degree of probability. Every action refers to an unknown future. It is in this sense always a risky speculation. The problems of truth and certainty concern the general theory of human knowledge. The problem of probability, on the other hand, is a primary concern of praxeology. Number 2, the meaning of probability. The treatment of probability has been confused by the mathematicians. From the beginning, there was an ambiguity in dealing with the calculus of probability. When the Chevalier de Mer consulted Pascal on the problems involved in the games of dice, the great mathematician should have frankly told his friend the truth, namely that mathematics cannot be of any use to the gambler in a game of pure chance. Instead, he wrapped his answer in the symbolic language of mathematics. What could easily be explained in a few sentences of mundane speech was expressed in a terminology which is unfamiliar to the immense majority and therefore regarded with reverential awe. People suspected that the puzzling formulas contained some important revelations hidden to the uninitiated. They got the impression that a scientific method of gambling exists and that the esoteric teachings of mathematics provide a key for winning. The heavenly mystic Pascal unintentionally became the patron saint of gambling. The textbooks of the calculus of probability gratuitously propagandize for the gambling casinos precisely because they are sealed books to the layman. No less havoc was spread by the equivocations of the calculus of probability in the field of scientific research. The history of every branch of knowledge records instances of the misapplication of the calculus of probability, which, as John Stuart Mill observed, made it the real opprobrium of mathematics. Some of the worst errors have arisen in our day in the interpretation of the methods of physics. The problem of probable inference is much bigger than those problems which constitute the field of the calculus of probability. Only preoccupation with a mathematical treatment could result in the prejudice that probability always means frequency. A further error confused the problem of probability with a problem of inductive reasoning as applied by the natural sciences. The attempt to substitute a universal theory of probability for the category of causality characterizes an abortive mode of philosophizing, very fashionable only a few years ago. A statement is probable if our knowledge concerning its content is deficient. We do not know everything which would be required for a definite decision between true and not true. But on the other hand, we do know something about it. We are in a position to say more than simply non licet or ignoramus. There are two entirely different instances of probability. We may call them class probability or frequency probability, and case probability, or the specific understanding of the sciences of human action. The field for the application of the former is the field of the natural sciences, entirely ruled by causality. The field for the application of the latter is the field of the sciences of human action, entirely ruled by teleology. Number 3, class probability. Class probability means we know or assume to know, with regard to the problem concerned, everything about the behavior of a whole class of events or phenomena. But about the actual singular events or phenomena, we know nothing, but that they are elements of this class. We know, for instance, that there are 90 tickets in a lottery, and that 5 of them will be drawn. Thus, we know all about the behavior of the whole class of tickets. But with regard to the singular tickets, we do not know anything, but that they are elements of this class of tickets. We have a complete table of mortality for a definite period of the past in a definite area. If we assume that with regard to mortality, no changes will occur, we may say that we know everything about the mortality of the whole population in question. But with regard to the life expectancy of the individuals, we do not know anything but that they are members of this class of people. For this defective knowledge, the calculus of probability provides a presentation in symbols of the mathematical terminology. It neither expands nor deepens nor complements our knowledge. It translates it into mathematical language. Its calculations repeat in algebraic formulas what we knew beforehand. They do not lead to results that would tell us anything about the actual singular events. And of course, they do not add anything to our knowledge concerning the behavior of the whole class, as this knowledge was already perfect, or was considered perfect, at the very outset of our consideration of the matter. It is a serious mistake to believe that the calculus of probability provides the gambler with any information which could remove or lessen the risk of gambling. It is, contrary to popular fallacies, quite useless for the gambler, as is any other mode of logical or mathematical reasoning. It is the characteristic mark of gambling that it deals with the unknown, with pure chance. The gambler's hopes for success are not based on substantial considerations. The non-superstitious gambler thinks, there is a slight chance, or in other words, it is not impossible, that I may win. I am ready to put up the stake required. I know very well that in putting it up, I am behaving like a fool. But the biggest fools have the most luck. Anyway. Cool reasoning must show the gambler that he does not improve his chances by buying 2 tickets instead of 1 of a lottery, in which the total amount of the winnings is smaller than the proceeds from the sale of all tickets. If he were to buy all the tickets, he would certainly lose a part of his outlay. Yet every lottery customer is firmly convinced that it is better to buy more tickets than less. The habitués of the casinos and slot machines never stop. They do not give a thought to the fact that, because the ruling odds favor the banker over the player, the outcome will the more certainly result in a loss for them the longer they continue to play. The lore of gambling consists precisely in its unpredictability and its adventurous vicissitudes. Let us assume that 10 tickets, each bearing the name of a different man, are put into a box. 1 ticket will be drawn, and the man whose name it bears will be liable to pay $100. Then an insurer can promise to the loser full indemnification if he is in a position to insure each of the 10 for a premium of $10. He will collect $100 and will have to pay the same amount to one of the 10. But if he were to insure one of them at a fixed rate by the calculus, he would embark not upon an insurance business but upon gambling. He would substitute himself for the insured. He would collect $10 and would get the chance either of keeping it or of losing that $10 and $90 more. If a man promises to pay at the death of another man a definite sum and charges for this promise the amount adequate to the life expectancy as determined by the calculus of probability, he is not an insurer but a gambler. Insurance, whether conducted according to business principles or according to the principle of mutuality, requires the insurance of a whole class, or what can reasonably be considered as such. Its basic idea is pooling and distribution of risks, not the calculus of probability. The mathematical operations that it requires are the four elementary operations of arithmetic. The calculus of probability is mere byplay. This is clearly evidenced by the fact that the elimination of hazardous risk by pooling can also be effected without any recourse to actuarial methods. Everybody practices it in his daily life. Every businessman includes in his normal cost accounting the compensation for losses, which regularly occur in the conduct of affairs. Regularly means, in this context, the amount of these losses is known as far as the whole class of the various items is concerned. The fruit dealer may know, for instance, that one of every 50 apples will rot in his stock, but he does not know to which individual apple this will happen. He deals with such losses as with any other item in the bill of costs. The definition of the essence of class probability, as given above, is the only logical satisfactory one. It avoids the crude circularity implied in all definitions referring to the equiprobability of possible events. In stating that we know nothing about actual singular events except that they are elements of a class, the behavior of which is fully known, this vicious circle is disposed of. Moreover, it is superfluous to add a further condition called the absence of any regularity in the sequence of the singular events. The characteristic mark of insurance is that it deals with the whole class of events. As we pretend to know everything about the behavior of the whole class, there seems to be no specific risk involved in the conduct of the business. Neither is there any specific risk in the business of the keeper of a gambling bank or in the enterprise of a lottery. From the point of view of the lottery enterprise, the outcome is predictable, provided that all tickets have been sold. If some tickets remain unsold, the enterpriser is in the same position with regard to them as every buyer of a ticket is with regard to the tickets he bought. Number 4, case probability. Case probability means we know with regard to a particular event some of the factors which determine its outcome, but there are other determining factors about which we know nothing. Case probability has nothing in common with class probability but the incompleteness of our knowledge. In every other regard, the two are entirely different. There are, of course, many instances in which men try to forecast a particular future event on the basis of their knowledge about the behavior of the class. A doctor may determine the chances for the full recovery of his patient if he knows that 70% of those afflicted with the same disease recover. If he expresses his judgment correctly, he will not say more than the probability of recovery is 0.7. That is, that out of 10 patients, not more than 3 on the average die. All such predictions about external events, i.e., events in the field of the natural sciences, are of this character. They are, in fact, not forecasts about the issue of the case in question, but statements about the frequency of the various possible outcomes. They are based either on statistical information or simply on the rough estimate of the frequency derived from non-statistical experience. So far as such types of probable statements are concerned, we are not faced with case probability. In fact, we do not know anything about the case in question, except that it is an instance of a class, the behavior of which we know or think we know. A surgeon tells a patient who considers submitting himself to an operation that 30 out of every 100 undergoing such an operation die. If the patient asks whether this number of deaths is already full, he has misunderstood the sense of the doctor's statement. He has fallen prey to the error known as the gambler's fallacy. Like the roulette player who concludes from a run of 10 red in succession that the probability of the next turn being black is now greater than it was before the run. He confuses case probability with class probability. All medical prognoses, when based only on physiological knowledge, deal with class probability. A doctor who hears that a man he does not know has been seized by a definite illness will, on the basis of his general medical experience, say, his chances for recovery are 7-3. If the doctor himself treats the patient, he may have a different opinion. The patient is a young, vigorous man. He was in good health before he was taken with the illness. In such cases, the doctor may think the mortality figures are lower. The chances for this patient are not 7-3, but 9-1. The logical approach remains the same, although it may be based not on a collection of statistical data, but simply on a more or less exact resume of the doctor's own experience with previous cases. What the doctor knows is always only the behavior of classes. In our instance, the class is the class of young, vigorous men seized by the illness in question. Case probability is a particular feature of our dealing with problems of human action. Here, any reference to frequency is inappropriate, as our statements always deal with unique events, which as such, i.e., with regard to the problem in question, are not members of any class. We can form a class, American presidential elections. This class concept may prove useful or even necessary for various kinds of reasoning, as for instance, for a treatment of the matter from the viewpoint of constitutional law. But if we are dealing with the election of 1944, either before the election with its future outcome, or after the election with an analysis of the factors which determine the outcome, we are grappling with an individual, unique, and non-repeatable case. The case is characterized by its unique merits. It is a class by itself. All of the marks which make it permissible to subsume it under any class are irrelevant for the problem in question. Two football teams, the Blues and the Yellows, will play tomorrow. In the past, the Blues have always defeated the Yellows. This knowledge is not knowledge about a class of events. If we were to consider it as such, we would have to conclude that the Blues are always victorious and that the Yellows are always defeated. We would not be uncertain with regard to the outcome of the game. We would know for certain that the Blues will win again. The mere fact that we consider our forecast about tomorrow's game as only probable shows that we do not argue this way. On the other hand, we believe that the fact that the Blues were victorious in the past is not immaterial with regard to the outcome of tomorrow's game. We consider it as a favorable prognosis for the repeated success of the Blues. If we were to argue correctly according to the reasoning appropriate to class probability, we would not attach any importance to this fact. If we were not to resist the erroneous conclusion of the gambler's fallacy, we would, on the contrary, argue that tomorrow's game will result in the success of the Yellows. If we risk some money on the chance of one team's victory, the lawyers would qualify our action as a bet. They would call it gambling if class probability were involved. Everything that, outside the field of class probability, is commonly implied in the term probability, refers to the peculiar mode of reasoning involved in dealing with historical uniqueness or individuality. The specific understanding of the historical sciences. Understanding is always based on incomplete knowledge. We may know the motives of the acting men, the ends they are aiming at, and the means they plan to apply for the attainment of these ends. We have a definite opinion with regard to the effects to be expected from the operation of these factors. But this knowledge is defective. We cannot exclude beforehand the possibility that we have erred in the appraisal of their influence or have failed to take into consideration some factors whose interference we did not foresee at all or not in a correct way. Gambling, engineering, and speculating are three different modes of dealing with the future. The gambler knows nothing about the event on which the outcome of his gambling depends. All that he knows is the frequency of a favorable outcome of a series of such events, knowledge which is useless for his undertaking. He trusts to good luck. That is his only plan. Life itself is exposed to many risks. At any moment, it is endangered by disastrous accidents which cannot be controlled, or at least not sufficiently. Every man banks on good luck. He counts upon not being struck by lightning and not being bitten by a viper. There is an element of gambling in human life. Man can remove some of the crematistic consequences of such disasters and accidents by taking out insurance policies. In doing so, he banks upon the opposite chances. On the part of the insured, the insurance is gambling. His premiums were spent in vain if the disaster does not occur. With regard to non-controllable natural events, man is always in the position of a gambler. The engineer, on the other hand, knows everything that is needed for a technologically satisfactory solution of his problem, the construction of a machine. As far as some fringes of uncertainty are left in his power to control, he tries to eliminate them by taking safety margins. The engineer knows only soluble problems and problems which cannot be solved under the present state of knowledge. He may sometimes discover from adverse experience that his knowledge was less complete than he had assumed, and that he failed to recognize the indeterminateness of some issues which he thought he was able to control. Then he will try to render his knowledge more complete. Of course, he can never eliminate altogether the element of gambling present in human life. But it is his principle to operate only within an orbit of certainty. He aims at full control of the elements of his action. It is customary nowadays to speak of social engineering. Like planning, this term is a synonym for dictatorship and totalitarian tyranny. The idea is to treat human beings in the same way in which the engineer treats the stuff out of which he builds his bridges, roads, and machines. The social engineer's will is to be substituted for the will of the various people he plans to use for the construction of his utopia. Mankind is to be divided into two classes, the almighty dictator on the one hand, and the underlings who are to be reduced to the status of mere pawns in his plans and cogs in his machinery on the other. If this were feasible, then of course the social engineer would not have to bother about understanding other people's actions. He would be free to deal with them as technology deals with lumber and iron. In the real world, acting man is faced with the fact that there are fellow men acting on their own behalf as he himself acts. The necessity to adjust his actions to other people's actions make him a speculator for whom success and failure depend on his greater or lesser ability to understand the future. Every investment is a form of speculation. There is, in the course of human events, no stability and, consequently, no safety. Number 5. Numerical Evaluation of Case Probability. Case probability is not open to any kind of numerical evaluation. What is commonly considered as such exhibits, when more closely scrutinized, a different character. On the eve of the 1944 presidential election, people could have said, A. I am ready to bet $3 against one that Roosevelt will be elected. B. I guess that out of the total amount of electors, 45 million will exercise their franchise, 25 million of whom will vote for Roosevelt. C. I estimate Roosevelt's chances as 9 to 1. D. I am certain that Roosevelt will be elected. Statement D is obviously inexact. If asked under oath on the witness stand whether he is as certain about Roosevelt's future victory as about the fact that a block of ice will melt when exposed to a temperature of 150 degrees, our man would have answered no. He would have rectified his statement and would have declared, I am personally fully convinced that Roosevelt will carry on. That is my opinion. But of course, this is not certainty, only the way I understand the conditions involved. The case of statement A is similar. This man believed that he risked very little when laying such a wager. The relation 3 to 1 is the outcome of the interplay of two factors, the opinion that Roosevelt will be elected and the man's propensity for betting. Statement B is an evaluation of the outcome of the impending event. Its figures refer not to a greater or smaller degree of probability, but to the expected result of the voting. Such a statement may be based on a systematic investigation like the Gallup poll or simply on estimates. It is different with statement C. This is a proposition about the expected outcome couched in arithmetical terms. It certainly does not mean that out of 10 cases of the same type, 9 are favorable for Roosevelt and 1 unfavorable. It cannot have any reference to a class probability. But what else can it mean? It is a metaphorical expression. Most of the metaphors used in daily speech imaginatively identify an abstract object with another object that can be apprehended directly by the senses. Yet this is not a necessary feature of metaphorical language, but merely a consequence of the fact that the concrete is, as a rule, more familiar to us than the abstract. As metaphors aim at an explanation of something which is less well known by comparing it with something better known, they consist, for the most part, in identifying something abstract with a better known concrete. The specific mark of our case is that it is an attempt to elucidate a complicated state of affairs by resorting to an analogy borrowed from a branch of higher mathematics, the calculus of probability. As it happens, this mathematical discipline is more popular than the analysis of the epistemological nature of understanding. There is no use in applying the yardstick of logic to a critique of metaphorical language. Analogies and metaphors are always defective and logically unsatisfactory. It is usual to search for the underlying tertium comparationis, but even this is not permissible with regard to the metaphor we are dealing with. For the comparison is based on a conception which is in itself faulty in the very frame of the calculus of probability, namely the gambler's fallacy. In asserting that Roosevelt's chances are 9-1, the idea is that Roosevelt is, in regard to the impending election, in the position of a man who owns 90% of all tickets of a lottery in regard to the first prize. It is implied that this ratio 9-1 tells us something substantial about the outcome of a unique case in which we are interested. There is no need to repeat that this is a mistaken idea. No less impermissible is the recourse to the calculus of probability in dealing with hypotheses in the field of the natural sciences. Hypotheses are tentative explanations consciously based on logically insufficient argument. With regard to them, all that can be asserted is, the hypothesis does or does not contradict either logical principles or the facts as experimentally established and considered as true. In the first case, it is untenable. In the second case, it is, under the present state of our experimental knowledge, not untenable. The intensity of personal conviction is purely subjective. Neither frequency probability nor historical understanding enters into the matter. The term hypothesis applied to definite modes of understanding historical events is a misnomer. If a historian asserts that in the fall of the Romanov dynasty, the fact that this house was of German background played a relevant role, he does not advance a hypothesis. The facts on which his understanding is founded are beyond question. There was a widespread animosity against Germans in Russia, and the ruling line of the Romanovs, having for 200 years intermarried exclusively with scions of families of German descent, was viewed by many Russians as a Germanized family, even by those who assumed that Tsar Paul was not the son of Peter III. But the question remains what the relevance of these facts was in the chain of events which brought about the dethronement of this dynasty. Such problems are not open to any elucidation other than that provided by understanding.